Welcome to Nightlife, the podcast.
We're going to kick off with geopolitics tonight. We've got our resident international relations expert, Dr. Ben Zala, with us. There is plenty to dissect. The Iran war's flaring up again 6 months after this so-called quick war started. Relations between the US and its closest neighbour, Canada, have taken even more of a dive than they had already taken. There has also been a deal on Venezuelan oil. So that's US foreign policy under Donald Trump for you. Hello, Ben. Welcome back.
Hi, Suzanne. Thanks for having me back.
Should you say, Ben, senior lecturer in politics and international relations at Monash University too. So look, we've now passed 6 months of the war between America and Iran, which was meant to be over very, very quickly. What's your assessment of where things are at from a geopolitical standpoint?
Well, I think where we're at is pretty much a textbook stalemate. Neither side has really achieved exactly what it would like, particularly the US side, remembering that the United States initiated the war. Iran wouldn't be entirely pleased with the outcome either. Their military has been majorly depleted, but it has enough leverage because it has the ability to effectively close the Strait of Hormuz, which is an incredibly important international shipping lane, or an area where ships need to be transiting through, because about a fifth of the world's oil needs to transit through that area. And that's really put all that pressure that we've seen on oil prices. And that's taken a toll in the US, not least in terms of Donald Trump's popularity with the American voters, which is going to become more important as we get closer to the US midterms in November. So really it is an issue of complete stalemate, where there was this memorandum of understanding which had brought some of the hostilities to a lower level. It wasn't actually a ceasefire. Both sides continued to hit each other with missiles through that period. But that has expired on the 17th of August, and there haven't really been any breakthroughs at all in the negotiations for a lasting peace deal. And so I expect we're going to be pretty much in this situation at least until the American midterms, because the Iranians have really no incentive now to capitulate or roll over to American demands.
Given the situation, what would you imagine Iran's aims are now? I mean, obviously they don't want this war to continue forever. Or, I mean, Vice President of the US, J.D. Vance, says it's not even been categorized as a war. But clearly they would want it to end at some point. But what would their objectives be about how they would like to come out of it?
Yeah, I think that's right. They absolutely do want an end to it as soon as possible. Iran needs its own oil to be transiting through that strait as much as anything else. But I think what they're most keen to avoid is an outcome in which it looks as if they've basically given in to US demands. Because we've got to remember, this is now the second time in 2 years that the Iranians have been attacked by outside forces. So there was the Israeli strikes midway through last year, which the Americans ended up joining, and then the US strikes in February of this year. And so what Iran wants to try and reestablish is some kind of deterrence of at least those two actors. They need to deter them from hitting them again. This can't be just something that Washington and Tel Aviv decide to do when it suits them. The Iranians want to establish some degree of deterrence there. And they also want to be able to look like they have withstood this US pressure and come out as a reasonably strong, at least regional actor in the Middle East. And so far, they seem to be somewhat on track for doing so. They've basically shown the world that if you do push them into a corner, they do have this this sort of lever they can pull of effectively closing the Strait of Hormuz, which has huge implications for global supply chains. And we all feel it at the petrol pump at the petrol station. So they're really looking to not be forced into some sort of bad deal for them. They may also be just biding time, particularly on the nuclear program. We don't know exactly where their nuclear program is at now because of those strikes last year and those sites that were destroyed, and we don't have access to them with international inspectors anymore. What they might have concluded from all of this is that actually they do need nuclear weapons. They will just be fair game until they develop their own nuclear weapons program. And what they might be doing is biding time until they can get a crash program underway and up and running. I think in the short term, what they're definitely doing is just trying to wait out until those midterm elections in November in the United States, in which probably the most likely outcome is a weakened Trump administration, which may well lose control of Congress. And that means that they will be negotiating with or bargaining with a much, much weaker actor.
How important do you think it is, Ben, for Iran, from its perspective, to have ongoing control of the Strait of Hormuz in order to, as you say, send that deterrent, to send that message that it is a strong player, that it's a player that's not to be feared? Do you think Iran will be desperately wanting to keep that control?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's been their most effective sort of card that they've played in this. Because it's the thing that can really hurt other states, not just the United States, but others who may well then put pressure on the US to come to an earlier conclusion, or at least to stop attacking Iranian assets. So the thing that they absolutely need to keep control of is the Strait of Hormuz. And they seem to be able to do that relatively easily and relatively cheaply, particularly through the use of things like sea mines, but also things like drones, which aren't all that expensive to manufacture. They can do it at scale. And so they can sort of signal to the world that if you want to play this game, we can keep cutting off this transit point for global shipping for as long as we like.
Now, one of my texters is saying that Trump has the Strait blocked. Who is actually in control of the Strait at the moment? Who's to be believed?
So, well, this is a strange thing. Technically speaking, they kind of both do. So Iran closed it to begin with, but then the United States imposed a naval blockade on Iran, which in effect closes it at least for shipping that the US doesn't want to let through, mainly in this case, Iranian shipping. So actually both of them have closed it at different points and to different ships coming through. And of course, that then becomes this sort of tit-for-tat retaliatory action, in which if the US are going to continue to blockade Iranian ships, then the Iranians aren't going to reopen the strait and let international shipping through, certainly not any American ships and so forth. So really, both sides are going to have to back down and withdraw if that strait is to open up to the sort of free-flowing international shipping we saw before the war broke out.
Now, from the American perspective, what kind of options does President Donald Trump have? And do you think he would like this very much over now before the midterms?
Look, I think he would. Not least because he needs a couple of easy wins to sell to the American public. Everybody knows, including the American public, that this was a conflict started by the Trump administration. Regardless of your opinion on whether it was a good idea, a bad idea, whatever, but the fact of it is it was an unprovoked attack. The Iranians didn't strike American assets first or anything like that. So the timetable was set by the Trump administration, and that sort of means ultimately he's got a sort of, you break it, you own it type policy here. He's the one who started this, which means everyone's looking to the Trump administration to have some sort of ending to this, which was actually beneficial to the American population. And so far, they're just not seeing it. So I wouldn't want to be a US president going into midterm elections where I'm hoping my party doesn't get hit at those elections, having undertaken an action like this and have most of the population looking at it thinking, what have we actually gained from this except for higher oil prices?
Now, Ben, I don't know if this is the kind of thing you can do, but if you were actually going to solve this problem, what kind of solution do you think might actually work? What would you be presenting?
I think what I would be trying to do is what you might think of as something at least very different from the memorandum of understanding they signed in June. What that did was bundle a whole bunch of issues together and word the agreement in a very, very vague way, which could basically be interpreted by both sides in any way they wanted. I think what they need to do is separate out a whole bunch of issues. I would be separating out this immediate conflict between the United States and Iran from the larger issue of the Iranian nuclear program. program. I'd treat them as fundamentally separate things, because I don't think we're going to get an easy solution to the nuclear issue anytime soon. So I think if you tag the two of them together, we're doomed to be in this cycle for a very, very long time. And equally, I would try and separate out issues relating to both Lebanon and Gaza, because one of the things that we saw was this MOU was worded in a way that basically said that the ceasefire was meant to apply to both Lebanon and Gaza. But of course, the Israelis said, we're not party to this. We didn't sign this agreement. We will attack whatever we want to attack. And so then the Iranians said, well, look, there are still attacks going on in both Lebanon and Gaza. Therefore, the agreement's been broken and so forth. So I think for me, I would actually be siloing out these issues and trying to separate them and get an immediate ceasefire, get some immediate concessions from both sides in relation to reopening the Strait of Hormuz, a genuine ceasefire in terms of ending the missile strikes from each side, and then say, we hope to resolve the nuclear issue in the future. We will continue to work with other states in the region on issues in Lebanon and Gaza, but not to sort of link them all together. I think that's a recipe for disaster.
All right, we'll send you in, Ben, see what you might be able to do. Dr. Ben Zahler is with us, Senior Lecturer in Politics and International Relations at Monash University. We are looking at the world through a geopolitical lens tonight. We do have quite a few questions and comments actually coming in relation to this. Grant in Waterloo, good evening.
Good evening, Suzanne. How are you?
Well.
That's it. And for Ben, thanks for having this topic. Just a quick one, and I'll try to keep it for Ben to keep it as precise as I can for that section. How would the impact of what the US is going through, the amount of, especially the weapons and the amount of resources they're devoting to that, how does that impact on their submarine building and the fact that they're behind
the dollars that are being thrown in towards that, the
submarines per year?
Thanks, Grant. Yeah, really good question.
And if you can expand
very, very important one
how that
for Australia at the moment, of course.
Yeah.
The impact of the reduction of weapons stockpiles. So the United States has been running down majorly its stockpiles of missiles, and including interceptor missiles for missile defense systems throughout this conflict, because if you keep shelling these sites, you keep hitting them with missiles, you keep having to intercept the Iranian missiles that they send in retaliation, those stockpiles are going to run down pretty quickly, and they don't have the sort of industrial base that you would normally have during a full-scale sort of wartime mobilization to keep up with the numbers. So the US stockpiles are dwindling very dramatically, and lots of people who are sort of in the US defense industry and the US military are very, very concerned about that, because they're saying, look, we've basically picked this fight. This was a war of choice. We're running down our stockpiles. If we find ourselves in a conflict that we didn't choose to enter, that we didn't choose the timeline on, we could be in real trouble here. How it relates to the building of submarines, I don't think it necessarily changes the rate at which attack class submarines are going to be made in the US shipyards. That is already something that is under massive strain, because it's had underinvestment for many, many years. They've had real trouble getting their shipyards up to par in terms of the output, the types and the amount of submarine hulls that they need to build. I don't think it's necessarily affected by the war, but it's still a pretty bleak situation. And the AUKUS deal rests on the US being able to build enough submarines so that those second-hand Virginia-class submarines that they're going to sell to us don't come at the cost of the US Navy. And there's actually an act of Congress that was passed that said basically the US Secretary of the Navy has to sign off on this, that says this sale of the submarines to the Australians won't come at our expense, that we won't leave ourselves sort of undermanned, as it were, in terms of submarines. And at this rate, they're not on track for that to be the case. So it's something in terms of the AUKUS deal that puts a really big question mark over it.
Dr. Ben Zahler is here, we are talking geopolitics. I think we could probably spend the next hour talking about Iran with the various questions that are coming in, but we are going to have a look at America's relationship with Canada in a moment. Firstly though, Gary has a question. It's a little off that topic, but I think it's an interesting one, and then we'll come back to Canada. Evening, Gary.
Hello. Hello. Is it Ben?
Hi, Gary. That's right.
Yeah. Just a quick question with the changes around NATO, and you've got Sweden and Finland recently joined, and so their sort of independence, which they'd had for since the Second World War, has diminished in that sense. And you've got the build-up of Germany's got the most money they've ever spent on defence since the Second World War, and you've got a pulling together of the European countries against, I suppose, America's position, with Canada being pulled into that as well, and a diminishing of the relationship between Canada and the US. How do you see that playing out against the overall sort of objective of Mr. Putin of getting the gang back together again and rebuilding Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union as a bloc, and the role that China could play in all that, please?
Well, just a little question then.
just a small one. Thanks, Gary. Yeah, it's a really good question. NATO looks very different today than it did only a few years ago. As you say, the Swedes and the Finns joining NATO really was thought of as absolutely impossible until really quite recently. I think what NATO countries are currently doing is trying to work very, very quickly to accommodate themselves to really a new strategic landscape. And it comes from both sides. On the one hand, the Russian threat, which is what NATO was all about to begin with. That was the whole point of the alliance formed in 1949. It was the Soviet threat at the time. The Russian threat looks much, much more serious than it did for the entirety of the post-Cold War period. And so European countries were already trying to bolster their contributions to NATO and thinking very, very carefully about what they were acquiring in terms of defence capabilities and their ability to operate together and so forth. And then on the other hand, the US support for NATO, which had basically been a given. It wasn't something that anyone seriously questioned. Yes, the Americans might complain from time to time and sort of gently accuse NATO countries of free riding a little bit and say, look, it would be good if you guys were spending a bit more. You weren't quite so reliant on us. But on the whole, the United States really liked playing the lead role in NATO and really being the state that was disproportionately more powerful and influential within NATO. And under Trump, that's really gone out the window. I mean, Trump is openly disdainful of NATO as an alliance, clearly doesn't value it. And we're starting to see this creep in already. There was just very recently during the week, there was a NATO joint exercise on anti-submarine warfare, where they basically practice working together to find Russian submarines. And for the first time in decades, that exercise was done without a single bit of American contribution. There was no American aircraft. There was no American ships involved in the exercise. And again, until very, very recently, that would have been absolutely unheard of. So I think NATO countries are really scrambling to try and work out how can they best deter Russia under what's going to be very, very trying circumstances if the state that who was the most powerful state within the NATO enterprise and the one that they all assumed would be there and at the heart of it may not actually be there in the crunch.
So I'm just wondering, and thanks very much for that question, Gary, do you imagine, Ben, and we could apply this more broadly to all the things that we're discussing, that, you know, when the Trump administration comes to an end, should it swing back to the Democrats, do you think everything that has happened in this term will sort of be magically undone, or are there permanent changes and, you know, discussions that have really changed the outlook for people going forward about issues such as NATO and national security?
No, I think some of these changes actually will be permanent, because it doesn't really matter if it swings back to the Democrats, or even if it's the Republicans again and you just get a more quote-unquote normal US president that is sort of very internationalist, sees its role as being the world's policeman, all the rest. What this has shown now over two terms of the Trump administration is that we can't take that for granted anymore. I mean, it used to be that you had this basic bipartisan approach to this in Washington. And so despite the fact that each administration would come to power would have a different focus. Some might be a bit more internationalist, others might be a little bit more isolationist, or at least have different priorities. This has really shaken the foundations of the assumptions that the United States will necessarily always see its interests as being that which puts it at the heart of things like NATO or its alliance system in Asia or whatever it is. We've now had an American president who says, actually, we might conceive of our interests quite differently, quite narrowly, and perhaps in some cases very differently to our own allies. And so to be having open disagreements with European countries, having, you know, this incredible disagreement with the Canadians, this has really shown states that we can't take for granted the old American role in the world, because we don't know what's coming down the line. So maybe a Democrat comes back into office for another 4 years, but then who's coming after them? Is it going to be President Vance? Is it going to be President Hegseth? Is it going to be President Trump Jr.? Who knows? I think some things here have really pushed us past a point of no return. And that isn't necessarily a bad thing. We perhaps were a little complacent about America's role in the world and assuming that it would always be the way that it had been for previous decades. Nothing's forever in international politics. And so I think states now will be looking at their relationship with the US very, very differently, no matter who wins the next election.
Yeah, but to what extent does the US need allies? I mean, it's gone into to the situation in Iran with basically only Israel really assisting it. You know, it, going forward, doesn't it need its friends who it's busy alienating in all sorts of ways?
Well, look, probably from an Australian, therefore a key ally of the United States, this is going to sound like a self-serving answer. But I think the short answer is yes. One of the things that gives the US such an advantage in the world in terms of its position in the global order is it's the only major power that has this incredible network of alliances all around the world. The Russians don't have this, the Chinese don't have this, the Indians don't have this. And so it's really, a USP, it's a unique selling point for the United States. It's just that the current president doesn't see it that way. And I think if you see how badly the war has gone in with Iran, it's a pretty good indicator that had they had some more support from allies, if they had actually been able to do something like consult with allies and really bring them on board with it, that it may not have been quite as difficult as it has been.
Dr. Ben Zala is here, Senior Lecturer in Politics and International Relations at Monash University. Well, let's quickly touch on Canada then, Ben. Is this the lowest point that the Canadian-American relationship has reached? I guess I know they were having a war back in about 1814 and the Canadians and British burnt the White House. But if we put that aside, in recent years, is this kind of one of the lowest points it's been at?
Yeah, save burning the White House to the ground. Yeah. It does feel like this is probably the lowest point. It's certainly in recent memory. There's really been nothing like this. I mean, the US-Canada relationship, like any relationship, has had its up and downs, but it's never been as openly hostile as this. A bit like taking for granted your allies, one of the things that critics of Donald Trump point to, they say that the United States has this incredible advantage of having very few neighbours in terms of its borders. It's really got one to the north, one to the south, and both of them have been relatively stable and not really posed any kind of a threat to the United States. And that's really not something to be sniffed at. That's something that really bolsters your power. You can afford to be taking on great powers overseas in Europe and in Asia, you know, Russia, China, so forth, because your strategic situation at home is so advantageous. Now, the Trump administration doesn't seem to see it in that way and has decided to pick a fight with its neighbor to the north and engaged in what really is a very straightforward trade war. And in fact, that's actually a phrase that the Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney has actually embraced. He's referring to this as a trade war. And he says, you know, when you're at war, you have to defend yourself, and sometimes that requires retaliating and so forth. This is really not anything I don't think anyone would have envisaged, including Canadian leaders and diplomats who, you know, probably had some sense that the second Trump administration might be a bit rocky in terms of their relationship, but I don't think anyone thought it would be quite this bad.
Now, let's finally look at Venezuela, because US President Donald Trump, well, he does love a deal. In the past week, we've had an announcement about a deal with Venezuela about its oil. And this will basically involve granting US companies access to about 65 billion barrels of crude oil reserves over the next 100 years. What can we read into this deal?
Well, I think there's two things. One is this is the ultimate payoff of that really quite brazen action at the outset of the year, early days of January. Remember, US Special Forces kidnapped the sitting Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, and his wife at gunpoint from their residence and took them off to the United States to stand trial on basically drug charges. Maduro is now in custody in New York. His lawyers were actually in court just this week saying that the charges should be dismissed because the standard diplomatic convention, the standard diplomatic practice is for a sitting head of state to be granted immunity against these kind of charges. The technicality it's going to come down to in the US case is that the US hasn't actually recognized Maduro as the legitimate head of state of Venezuela since 2019. So this is really the payoff for that action, is that they now get this incredibly advantageous deal with a greatly weakened government in Caracas. This is a deal that has even been criticized by the opposition leader in Venezuela, Mercado, who was, if you remember, she's the woman who won the Nobel Peace Prize last year, much to Trump's chagrin, of course, but who actually sort of gifted the prize to him and was a great supporter of the kidnapping of Maduro at the beginning of the year. Even she's criticized this, saying this is not the kind of deal that should be struck with an unelected interim president in Venezuela, which is Delcy Rodriguez, who's sort of stepped up in the meantime, who Trump has openly threatened. I mean, he said publicly that if she doesn't do what's right, she'll pay a bigger price than Maduro. So she's clearly felt pretty vulnerable and has negotiated a deal that does seem extremely advantageous to the United States, and certainly in Trump's own reckoning, he says this is a great deal for the Americans. And I think this is really important for Trump because oil prices have remained really, really high. They don't appear to be going down anytime soon, given that there doesn't seem to be any chance of any kind of resolution to the Iranian issue, and they're not going to be opening the Strait of Hormuz anytime soon. The US imports lots and lots of oil from Canada. About 60% of Canada's trade to the United States is oil. And so far, they've only put a 10% tariff on that, but this trade war is escalating and that could go higher. So that's only going to push oil prices even further up for the American consumer. So I think for Trump, this deal is his kind of get out of jail free card. This is his one chance at maybe looking like he's one of his foreign policy escapades has resulted in a win for the American consumer, and that it actually might get them some relief at the gas pump, as they say.
So with those midterms now less than 2 months away, in which you say that the power in the Senate or the House could well change, geopolitically, what will people be watching for with the outcome of those midterms? What might change?
Well, what might change is the Trump administration may be much more domestically focused. They might have to turn inward and really try and reverse what has been a pretty secular trend downwards in his approval ratings, because this is where the Republican Party may start to turn on him a bit. I mean, so far the Republican Party has been happy enough to basically go along with Trump because he's brought them to power twice now. And for many Republicans, he's not exactly their ideal candidate, but they've been happy enough to sort of hold their nose and go along with it. But if he starts to become a liability for them, well, then he's going to end up himself basically being at war with his own party. And that's really something that's going to draw Trump's attention domestically, going to draw it inwards. And you may see much, much less time and attention is being spent on these foreign policy issues. That doesn't mean that, you know, they'll basically withdraw from the world. They'll still be well in, entwined with things in the Middle East. They've still got many interests in our neck of the woods, in Asia and so forth. But just that time and attention and so forth is much more likely to be turned inwards as he has to battle with his own party.
Yeah, might a very bad result for the Republicans result in the president deciding he needs to get out of Iran, whatever the cost?
It might do. It might force him into striking a quick deal to make it look like he's sort of got the victory that he's looking for. Trump is the sort of the ultimate spin man, as it were. He likes to sort of take whatever actions, whether it's going personally bankrupt or something else, and turn it into a good news story. And he's very, very good at it. He's very adept at it. So he might look for a quick solution to the Iranian issue. It may result in sort of backing off on the Canadian trade war. Who knows? It also could have the opposite effect, though. Sometimes when leaders feel embattled domestically, they do what we call a rally round the flag action, where you basically start a conflict overseas or start some sort of controversy overseas so that everyone gets behind their president because it looks like it's an us and them situation, and you know, it's this patriotic moment that you need to support your own president as we're going into bat against this foreign power. So it might mean that he ends up doing the opposite and actually lashing out externally. We just don't know. He's a pretty unpredictable character, and I think all of us have learned over the first term and a half now that prediction with Trump is just a fool's errand.
Ben, thanks so much for being with us once again on Nightlife tonight. Really appreciate it.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Dr. Ben Zala is a senior lecturer in politics and international relations at Monash University.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.